I would ask them, why did this experience allow you to quit smoking? And they would say things to me like, well, I had this amazing experience, and I sprouted wings, and I flew all through European history, and I witnessed the witch trials, and I witnessed my body on the, you know, on a funeral pyre on the Ganges, and I realized the universe was full of so many amazing things to see and do that killing yourself with smoking seemed like a really stupid idea.
Author Michael Pollan has reviewed the latest research on the therapeutic uses of psychedelic drugs. He's even taken a few trips himself. Later in the show, we're going to talk to him about his new book. First, though, California's primary election is 1 week away. And while you might still be undecided about who you're going to vote for, a number of outside groups with some very deep pockets sure are not. They are pretty much decided. Take, for example, the race to be California's next governor. So far, unions, wealthy donors, and corporations have spent more than $26 million on that race alone. The LA Times reports that's the most money ever spent on a California primary by outside groups. It's the day after Monday, so Jessica Levinson is here to tell us everything we need to know about this. She is a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Monday, now Tuesday, legal, just this week, Tuesday.
Hi. Irish sprouted wings. I'm here.
Oh my gosh. I hope you're not going on some crazy trip. But stay with us. Who are these outside groups and what do they want?
Well, they want to try and sway our decisions at the ballot box. So the outside groups are like charter groups for charter schools. They're service employee unions. They are even health insurance groups. They're basically anyone in California who has deep pockets and thinks that they can either be benefited or hurt by who the next governor is, which means a lot of different people.
And who in particular do they like?
So the charter groups like Villaraigosa, and the service employee unions groups tend to like Newsom. And even there's some health insurance money that's going to Newsom. I think in large part because people tend to like to back winners, those who are actually going to have an effect on what our laws are in California. And I think anybody who has been following this race knows that the race is really just about who's going to be second.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so they're saying, okay, we know that Newsom will be in the top two. And so we're going to try to figure out who's going to be in that number two spot. Is it going to be Villaraigosa or John Cox?
And that's right. And this is a little different from what we've seen before, because when we have an open seat, we don't have an incumbent running. Jerry Brown is not running for his 17th term as California governor.
Right.
Because he can't. He's had another two times. And because we have our so-called jungle primary. So in this primary election, as the voters will see as they start to open their ballots, any voter can vote for any candidate. So it's not just that Democratic voters can vote for Democratic candidates, Republican voters for Republican candidates. So that's why it's a so-called open primary. And so the big question will be, is it going to be two Democrats? Will it be Newsom and Villaraigosa? Or will it be, as Newsom hopes, Newsom mm-hmm. and John Cox? Because if you look at the registration in California, it's fairly clear that a Democrat will be the next governor. And so these outside groups are kind of jockeying to try and see whether or not they can sway the needle and
right.
whether or not they can try and hurt Newsom and or help Villaraigosa.
Right. So they're airing some ads that they're not supposed to be coordinating with the campaign on. Right. And some of these ads, they're a little dirty, right?
So this is the kind of genius of independent expenditures, is that by law, they have to be independent, meaning not coordinated with the candidate campaign. But there's essentially no restrictions other than disclosure. So they can receive unlimited contributions, they can spend unlimited sums, and they can say things that they really want to get out there, but which they know a candidate really can't say. So for instance, if you want to say that, you know, John Cox is an arsonist, that's not something that one of the candidates wants to say, but it might really benefit Villaraigosa to get that out there. So an independent expenditure group who's very attuned to what the candidates need but isn't coordinating with the candidate can put out a negative message.
But can they say things that are patently untrue?
No.
Or libelous?
No. So that is actually a different area where there's a question of, can we make like blatantly false statements, and I certainly wasn't trying to push that off as a truthful statement, in political campaigns. And there's actually an enormous amount of room for crossing the line from truth to lies when it comes to political statements.
Is there anyone overseeing this, saying, okay, outside groups, you can't do this. This is dirty pool.
Yes, there's the California Fair Political Practices Commission, and they oversee, for instance, like these independent expenditure groups have been, some of them have been sued because the candidates have said, you know what, you're actually, you didn't file your disclosure report on time, or this isn't really about Gavin Newsom. This is really about John Cox. And so you should have filed it as a John Cox ad instead. And so the Fair Political Practices Commission, way after the election, when nobody is paying attention, will decide these issues. But what we all know is it's beneficial for candidates to be able to say, I actually filed a legal complaint with the Fair Political Practices Commission. That's how serious this transgression is.
Ah, okay. And meanwhile, they'll get some kind of slap on the wrist if they're found to have violated some rules or something.
Meanwhile, by no fault of the California Fair Political Practices Commission, someone will realize that this is the cost of doing business and that they will be happy to pay that fine.
Okay, let's turn to another story. This morning, the Supreme Court declined to hear a challenge to an Arkansas abortion law. So what does that mean?
So it means that they sent it back to the lower court. So this is an Arkansas abortion law that deals with medication to for people to have abortions in the first, I believe, 9 weeks of a pregnancy. And what the law says is that the doctor who's prescribing the pill needs to have a contractual relationship with another doctor who has admitting privileges in a hospital. Because what Arkansas is saying is we need to protect women to ensure that if there are any complications, you can go straight to a hospital. Now, a similar but somewhat different law from Texas was actually struck down by the Supreme Court. And they said that law would create an undue burden, which is the test in America for whether or not abortion laws go too far. And what the court did today is, frankly, they punted and they said this is going back down to the trial court. And they're going to make some additional findings as to whether or not this creates an undue burden. What Planned Parenthood, who's suing, has said, yes, it absolutely does. It's going to end up closing two of the three abortion clinics in Arkansas, and it will make it virtually impossible for a number of women to get these types of abortions, which are safer than other types which are offered.
So why would the court strike down the Texas law and then let the Arkansas law pretty much stand?
Well, it's a slightly different court than it was back when the different makeup of the court back when they made the Texas decision. It's also a slightly different law in the sense that what Justice Breyer, writing for majority in the Texas court, said is, well, in that case, you had to actually find a doctor with admitting privileges. And this just says your doctor has to have a contractual relationship. And so there's some kind of way to say, yes, there's a distinction between the two laws. I think that ultimately the court didn't want to make this decision. And so they said, let's go back for further findings. And sometimes the Supreme Court will do that. They'll say, let's let the lower courts flesh this out. Let's get a bigger record and you can come back to us if you want to. Now, if the district court doesn't make a decision blocking this Arkansas law, it will go into effect in 45 days in July. And you could see other states decide to follow suit and say, well, the Supreme Court didn't take up this case. There was no specific statement that this was not permissible. And so other states could try and follow.
Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School, and she joins us every Monday, Tuesday in this case, but back on Monday next week. Thank you.
Tuesdays after holidays.
Okay.
I'm not here all week, though.
All right. Thank you, Jessica.
Thank you.
Coming up, why the United States targeted the Chinese and wouldn't let them emigrate here, the decades-long Chinese Exclusion Act, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. America likes to think of itself as a nation of immigrants. The Statue of Liberty is a powerful symbol of that. America as a beacon for anyone who wants to make a better life. But throughout our history, the reality was at times a lot different, especially for the Chinese. As the Statue of Liberty was being assembled from parts sent from France in the late 19th century, the U.S. government passed a law that targeted the Chinese. It banned Chinese workers from immigrating to the United States, and it banned the Chinese people who are already here from becoming citizens. And that law existed for 60 years in various iterations. The Chinese Exclusion Act was not repealed until 1943. A new PBS special airing tonight explores this little-known chapter of American history. It's a chapter that echoes much of the immigration debate we're having today. Co-directors Rick Burns and Li Xinyu join me now. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us, Madeline.
Thanks for having us.
Great to have you both. Okay, so let's go back to the origins of anti-Chinese sentiment in the United States. And it existed before the passage of this Chinese Exclusion Act in 1882. What was the government's attitude toward Chinese immigration before that in the early part of the 19th century?
You know, there was a very positive attitude culturally towards the Chinese and towards Chinese culture in the colonial period and the early federal period. So it really wasn't until the Gold Rush when, after the 49ers, the world rushed in to brand new American California, that you began to have a dynamic which was quite new in America, where newly Americanized Californians were trying to determine who could belong to the state and the country and who could not.
And the Chinese came, like many others, to find gold, right?
Exactly. And as the economic vulnerability of the people down sort of the lower end of the economic brackets goes up, so does the tendency of politicians to play on their fears and angers and anxieties and help sort of create wedges out of, well, who are the foreigners? Who's really to blame? Who are the scapegoats that we can really single out as being the people who are stealing our jobs? It's astonishing, Madeline, the degree to which the kind of DNA of American attitudes towards the other and towards immigrants was really forged here, the rhetoric, the ideology, the legal actions, and also the almost frictionless, fact-free nature of the circumstances. The Chinese were small in numbers compared to the millions of, for example, the Irish immigrants who came in and who indeed were not always treated well.
Right.
But they were never othered in that particular way. And so this is a small number of people who very rapidly became a threat to your job. They were defined as not only like Mexicans are going to steal your job, they're like Muslims, a threat to the security of the nation. And it's remarkable how that's been the way, that's the kind of the structure of how these ideas and attitudes get put into play. So it's particularly frightening to see the entire apparatus being resurrected again today, and again, not for the first time. I mean, it's happened again and again throughout American history from the 1920s on down.
So leading up to the Chinese Exclusion Act being adopted in 1882, there was all this violence, mainly on the West Coast, all this anti-Chinese violence where cities up and down the West Coast were basically expelling the Chinese. Mobs were burning down their homes and basically kicking them out. And a particularly egregious example of that happened right here in Los Angeles in 1871 in Chinatown. Can you talk about what happened?
Yeah. I mean, that was an incident in which there was some argument on the ground, and it got blown out into just an incendiary mob just beset on Chinatown one night and just went from house to house, dragging Chinese out.
And as they capture Chinese people, they lynch them. They hang them from a church steeple. They hang them from the top of a covered wagon, from a gatepost. They cut off the finger of one of the Chinese men. One of those lynched is a child, and two Chinese women are lynched.
Some 18 were lynched that night. In one night, we associate mass lynching with African Americans in the South. But in fact, in 1871, it took place in Los Angeles, in Chinatown. Difficult to wrap your mind around it. But then after the law was passed, in effect, it seemed like this federal legislation gave permission to towns across the West. Some 300 towns were Chinese were either chased out, you know, violence set upon them, you know, entire cities, Eureka, Tacoma, large and small, entire population just chased out.
I guess I was wondering throughout watching your documentary, why they wanted to stay here, why they didn't just go back to China, because they were the subject of so much state-sanctioned racism and so much
violence.
There.
It was worse back in China. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Qing dynasty, the Manchu dynasty, was undergoing a century-long disintegration, which, of course, came to a culmination in the early decades of the 20th century. And America was very, very appealing. The rule of law was very, very appealing. The idea that one would be judged not by the color of one's skin, but by one's willingness to adhere to join a body politic that said no person was above the law. So even if those were incompletely implemented American ideals, they were nevertheless ideals that were there. They were enshrined in our documents, and they were documents, whether it was the Declaration of Independence or the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, that Chinese Americans knew. They frequently knew them better than non-Chinese Americans and cited them as early as 1852 to contest the people who would want to keep them out.
So the Chinese Exclusion Act was repealed in 1943 during World War II. This was no accident because we were at war with Japan and Japan had attacked China. Was it that the United States needed China as an ally?
Absolutely. Chinese had been the bad, feared Asian up to that point until FDR was able to sort of corral and got the repeal through. However, the repeal was very superficial because Chinese were under the strict quota of 105.
105 a year.
Yeah, a year.
People. 105,
105
people a year.
People a year.
And so how many Chinese do we accept today?
Many, many more than 105. but a new kind of filter is being put on it. We began to say, well, we want to have a certain kind of migrant. They're not going to be the old migrants, you know, farmers and lower middle class and working class people and middle class people. They're going to be the educated class who are going to sort of, you know, come and work in the new aerospace industry of California or in science and STEM technologies, as they were yet to call it. These are the kids, as May Nye, a wonderful historian at Columbia, puts it, you know, these are the kids who are going to keep your kids out of Harvard because they're all brilliant, they're all scientists, they're all doctors. May is quick to point out, it's really not like there are 1.3 billion doctors back in China, but if you set up your immigration structure such that you're favoring certain classes and certain educational standards over others, that's what it's going to grow to seem like. So, you know, the Chinese today, still another version of other, perhaps more satisfactory than it used to be to some, but nevertheless still not just people who are seen as part of the kind of the mainstream, kind of, quote, normal American.
Well, it's a fascinating look at an underlooked chapter of our history. It's called The Chinese Exclusion Act. It's on PBS tonight, 5 o'clock Pacific time. Rick Burns, Lee Hsien Yu, thank you so much.
Thank you, Madeline, for having us.
Coming up, writer Michael Pollan on psychedelic drugs and tripping.
If you get very anxious, you know, you're feeling scared, surrender. If you think you're dying or going crazy, go with it.
Pollan's new book on psychedelics, The Personal and the Political, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In 1971, Richard Nixon called Timothy Leary the most dangerous man in America, and then he launched the war on drugs.
America's public enemy number one in the United States is drug abuse. In order to fight and defeat this enemy, it is necessary to wage a new all-out offensive.
Well, that same year, the Controlled Substances Act outlawed the use of LSD and psilocybin, or magic mushrooms, classifying them as Schedule I drugs with a high risk for abuse and no medical value. But that's despite the fact that until then, these drugs were being used by psychiatrists to treat patients for depression, addiction, obsessive-compulsive disorder. In fact, more than 1,000 academic studies had been published about the possible benefits of psychedelic drugs. Well, after 1971, those studies all but disappeared. A few, though, have been trickling back recently. There's a resurgence in interest around psychedelic drugs. Author Michael Pollan has taken stock of the latest developments, and he's even taken a few trips himself. All for research, of course, for his latest book, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. And Michael Pollan joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you, Madeline. Good to be here.
Great to have you. All right. I mentioned that LSD was being used by psychiatrists and therapists back in the 50s and 60s, and a lot of that was happening here in Los Angeles. Tell us how they were using LSD with their patients.
Yeah. Through the whole decade of the 50s, there was a very active program exploring these strange new substances. And they were being used in a couple different ways. No one knew what they were good for. They seemed to make people act psychotic superficially. So they thought, well, maybe they could help us understand the mind of the schizophrenic. And then some other people tried them. And in those days, researchers would try medicines themselves before they gave it to anybody else. And they say, well, it doesn't feel like psychosis. And then they thought maybe they would be good for just as an adjunct to psychoanalysis or psychotherapy. And they began, especially in L.A., there was a group of psychiatrists there loosely centered around UCLA that were giving what were called psycholytic doses, and that means mind loosening, basically low doses of LSD to patients before they came in for their talk therapy. And they found that it lowered their defenses and allowed them to surface repressed material and get in touch with their emotions and problems and traumas in some cases. It wasn't enough to really trip, but it was enough to open up the mind. Mm-hmm. That was the thinking then. And Oscar Janiger was a psychiatrist in UCLA, and Stanley Cohen, and they were brilliant psychiatrists, and they worked with a lot of celebrities. It became a very popular thing in Hollywood. Jack Nicholson, Cary Grant, Andre Previn, and Cary Grant in 1959 gave an interview to a gossip columnist about the wonders of this treatment he'd undergone. He'd had 60 sessions, and he said that he had lost his ego and was reborn, and he felt that it had made him what he was. He also said it made him irresistible to women, which I thought was sounds kind of egotistical, actually.
Yeah, talking about the ego.
Yeah. And then as the decade went on, there were other research projects that experimented with much higher doses of LSD and psilocybin. And that became known as a psychedelic dose. And that simply means mind manifesting. And they found when you gave people this big dose, they would have a mystical experience. They would have this this sense of their ego dissolving and with that emerging into some larger entity that felt very spiritual. And that appeared to be therapeutic, that experience. It gave people a new perspective on what mattered, allowed them to shift their priorities, and in many cases, cure addictions. A very common use was to treat alcoholism.
So how did it get from the laboratory and from the psychiatrist's couch out into the streets of Haight-Ashbury and become the psychedelic that we all think of it today?
Yeah. I mean, the 60s experience with psychedelics definitely has shaped their reputation in ways that are, you know, really unfortunate, because it meant that all this, you know, very good research was lost to psychiatry and mental health care. You know, probably these drugs were bound to find their way into the culture. They were just too interesting and, for many people, too pleasurable. And, you know, we often blame Timothy Leary for this.
Turn on, tune in, and drop out.
This was the Harvard psychologist who studied psilocybin and LSD at Harvard for 3 years, from 1960 to 63, and he really becomes a psychedelic evangelist.
The kids who take LSD aren't going to fight your wars, middle-class, middle-aged, whiskey-drinking generals. They're not going to join your corporations, middle-class, middle-aged, whiskey-drinking corporation presidents.
And that's kind of what got Nixon so worked up, that, you know, he was selling it to the counterculture, basically. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Ken Kesey was, you know, the novelist, had been turned on out in Menlo Park by the CIA, of all people. They were conducting experiments, and they were paying people to come in, and they'd give you $50 or $75 to try their
their drugs. And Kesey had this mind-blowing experience and proceeded to turn on as many people as he could in the so-called acid tests. And then, you know, even Cary Grant, I think, had a big influence on people. This interview went viral, or whatever you would call it, in 1959. And they started to become a party drug in L.A. before 1960.
And so before Nixon's war on drugs and before there was this full-fledged panic, people weren't particularly worried about it. In fact, quite the opposite. They were really excited about it.
They were very excited. These were considered by many psychiatric wonder drugs. You know, they thought that they had learned something really important about the brain. And indeed, they had. I mean, the power of these drugs really, and the fact that such small quantities, LSD is active in amounts measured in micrograms, that suggested to people that brain chemistry was probably the cause of mental illness, or might be the cause of mental illness. And this sets off that whole idea that you have these special chemicals in your brain that mediate emotions. So it was a very positive story all through the 50s. And in fact, the press on psychedelics was astonishingly positive. Time Life, which was one of the great media empires at the time, owned by Henry Luce, he had been treated in L.A. With LSD by a psychiatrist. And he raved about it, as did his wife, Claire Booth Luce. And the coverage in Time and Life was uniformly exuberant. In fact, Luce told his staff that if they had any articles about LSD or psilocybin, he had to see them to make sure there weren't any negatives in them.
Really?
Wow. Yeah, it was kind of anti-censorship. In fact, the article that introduced psilocybin to the West, Magic Mushrooms, was first appeared in Life magazine in 1957. And that really introduced millions of Americans to the whole idea of psychedelic consciousness.
But then that was in the 50s, the mid-50s. Just 10 years after that, in the mid-60s, life turns against...
Yeah, everything changed.
As well as the rest of the media turns against LSD.
With incredible rapidity. Yeah. Basically, around 1965, and I can't point to a single cause, but there is a complete change in the weather, and everything you read about psychedelics suddenly is terrifying, including in Time and Life. They follow the culture, and there is this moral panic. And it has something to do with the rise of a counterculture, which was, you know, very destabilizing. Suddenly, young people in America were dressing differently than their parents, cutting their hair differently, different set of sexual mores. They were creating their own culture, which came to be called the counterculture.
You talk about the hippie. What is the hippie? Why don't you talk about the younger generation, the people who are changing? You talk about the people who know what's happening and don't agree with the old line of thinking.
And this freaked out their parents, and it freaked out people in power. And it was believed, and probably rightly so, that LSD and psilocybin had something to do with it. And Timothy Leary, you know, really taunted Nixon and others in power.
We're going to become the next governor of the state of California. We're going to start a new political party. And by party, we mean party. We want to turn on the whole state. There's no excuse for any Californian not to be high and happy and laughing all the time.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Michael Pollan, author of The Omnivore's Dilemma and of the new book, How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. Now, your interest in the subject was piqued by recent research, because there has been this resurgence, not as widespread, but some resurgence in research into LSD and psilocybin for treating addiction and depression.
Yeah, addiction, depression, anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, a whole range of mental illnesses. Not the psychoses, not things like schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. And they're basically, what's happening is this research grinds to a halt in the late 60s and early 70s. Nobody is doing it after 1976. The funding has dried up. And scientists are kind of embarrassed to go near this stuff. There's a real stigma.
But in the beginning in the 90s, some psychiatrists and some others, some activists really, who saw the potential of these drugs, started to organize to get the research restarted. And the FDA became a little more open to letting people work with it. And psilocybin became the drug of choice, the psychedelic of choice for this research, because it had less stigma attached to it than LSD. And they're basically picking up this thread that was dropped in the late 60s, early 70s, and redoing a lot of that research. And the results have been absolutely fascinating. Cancer patients who were struggling because of their diagnosis, many of them terminal, with anxiety and depression and fear, about 80% of the people who underwent a guided psychedelic journey, and I can explain exactly what that means, saw statistically significant reductions in standard measures of their depression and anxiety. And, you know, as one researcher said, we don't have any psychiatric intervention that effective in this situation. Very exciting.
What's the hypothesis as to why that was the result? Is it because that their actual brain chemistry was changed, or is it that they thought, okay,
only
this is what death is going to look like? Or
what's interesting about this treatment is that you are giving people a drug, but it is the kind of experience that drug occasions that appears to have the therapeutic effect. People have, many of them, have what's called a mystical experience. It's the experience of your ego, your sense of self dissolving. And when that happens, your defenses go way down. And you know, one of the things your ego does is kind of patrol the borders between you and the other, whether the other is other people or nature. And suddenly you feel like you're merging with something larger than yourself. And I think this is very comforting to people who are facing death. And if you think about it, philosophers have often said that that one of the keys to dying well is redefining your sense of self to take in more than the bag of bones you are, and, you know, extend it to your community, your family, your offspring, or all of nature, and that changes it. It's a less ego-driven experience. So, you know, we don't know exactly how the drugs lead to a mystical experience, but we have some ideas. They do appear to diminish activity in one particular brain network that is closely identified with our sense of self, something called the default mode network. And when they began imaging the brains of people on psychedelics, they were very surprised to find that this particular network, which is involved with self-reflection and the so-called autobiographical self, where we kind of write the stories of who we are and fold in information that's coming in, you know, from our experience. And it really is what gives us this abiding sense that we have a self. And it takes this network offline. And that can be very liberating because the ego can be a harsh master.
Yeah. And so I guess that's the same mechanism that works with people who are depressed or have anxiety.
Yeah. Right? In slightly different ways. I mean, take an example of people who struggle with addiction. They did a small pilot study with 15 smokers, giving them a psilocybin experience. And a very high number of them, I think, started at 80 and went down to 67% after a year, managed to quit. That's better than any other treatment we have by far. And I would ask them, why? Why did this experience allow you to quit smoking? And they would say things to me like, well, I had this amazing experience and I sprouted wings and I flew all through European history and I witnessed the witch trials and I witnessed my body on the, you know, on a funeral pyre on the Ganges. And I realized the universe was full of so many amazing things to see and do that killing yourself with smoking seemed like a really stupid idea. Now, this seems kind of banal.
Their parents tell them? I mean.
Yeah. But one of the hallmarks of the mystical experience is this conviction that whatever insights you had were not just subjective opinions, they were revealed truths. They had this incredible authority. And so I think that one of the curious things about psychedelics is that the most banal ideas, like love is the most important thing there is, suddenly take on this force. And it's a strong enough force that people can change their lives.
That's Michael Pollan. He also took his own trips on psychedelics, and I'll talk to him about that. You had several trips that you talk about in the book, and I wanted you to focus on your deepest trip, the one where you took a bigger dose of psilocybin, right?
Yeah.
Of mushrooms. You ate a whole big mushroom.
Oh, and then more, yeah.
And then some more. And it was with a guide.
Yeah, I should explain how that works, because using these drugs in a clinical or therapeutic context is very different than using them recreationally. You know, taking some mushrooms and going into the walk in the woods or going to a concert. So you work with someone who really knows the territory, and they're often a trained therapist. And this is true whether you're working above ground in university trials or underground, where I had to go to have my experiences. And there is underground this community of guides and therapists who know what they're doing and are very professional, very ethical. I'm sure there's charlatans out there, so there's no guarantee if you found an underground guide they'd be good. But I found several that I thought were terrific.
And underground because it's illegal.
It's illegal.
So what they're doing is illegal. Okay.
Yeah, they don't advertise, and you know, you find your way to them through word of mouth, and they're very careful who they take. And they also are scrupulous about, you know, making you fill out medical questionnaires. You know, as one of them said to me, we don't have very good insurance, so we have to be very careful. And they disqualify people who they think are at risk of mental illness, and that's very important. And so they're very, you know, they choose carefully, and as well they should. They start with a preparation session, telling you what to expect. They will basically encourage you to be very open to the experience and not fight whatever happens, however disturbing it is. So if you see a monster, they'll tell you, don't run away, surrender. Step right up to it and say, what do you have to teach me? If you get very anxious and you're feeling scared, surrender. If you think you're dying or going crazy, go with it. Surrender is a really key term. It's the resistance of what's happening in your mind that leads to panic attacks and what are called bad trips. Then sometimes they'll ask you to set an intention. You know, is there something you want to work on? Is it, do you want to quit smoking? Do you want to confront your mortality? Do you want to learn about your mind? Whatever it is. And that often will kind of direct the trip. And then when you're ready to start, they give you the substance, the medicine, as they always call it, for the journey. And you lie down on a comfortable futon or couch or whatever it is. You put on eye shades, so there's no visual stimulus, and you put on headphones, and you listen to a very carefully curated playlist of music. And the eye shades and the headphones do a very interesting thing. They make it a very internal trip. You're not kind of grooving on the patterns of light, you know, or the shadows on the wall. You're really going inside. And they're there with you the whole time. So you don't have to worry about anything. You don't have to worry if the FedEx guy is going to knock at the door or the phone's going to ring. You know, they create a safe space, as they say.
Did you ever feel panicky or that you were about to go on a bad trip and that you wanted to get out of it?
I had a couple moments where I felt this rising tide of anxiety. In the trip you're describing, I found myself as if I were inside a video game. It was this dystopian, computer-generated, black-and-white world. It was really unpleasant. It wasn't scary, but it was like, ooh, I'd rather be outside, please.
But why do you think your brain went there? Because you say in the book you don't play video games. You're not into them particularly.
Well, I think the reason my brain went there is I brought a computer into the treatment room because there was a test I wanted to subject myself to. So without going into the details of the test, I had brought computer graphics essentially into the room, and I looked at it a couple times, and that may well have done it. Or it was the music, which sounded like electronic music. And so every note of this synthesizer was conjuring they look like stalactites or stalagmites, what you see in a recording studio, you know, that kind of foam. Mm-hmm. And the whole world was made of that stuff, and I was traveling through it, and it was kind of beautiful in some ways, but it's not where I wanted to be. And so I did feel this rising tide of anxiety, but you know, I remembered trust and let go, you know, relax your mind and float downstream, as John Lennon famously wrote, and is often quoted by guides. And so that helped me get through it. And then when I increased the dose, something really strange and wonderful happened, and that was that my sense of self fell apart. it turned into a sheaf of little papers like Post-its that were blown into the wind. And I had no desire, and I realized this other I is a little confusing. It's paradoxical because there was another perceiving I that was having this experience of itself being dissolved. I had no desire to piece all the papers back together again. I was fine with it. And then I looked out again and I saw myself painted over the landscape. I was just this coat of paint over the landscape. And I was like, isn't that interesting? I wasn't panicked at all. I was just kind of thinking about, what does that mean? Well, it means maybe I'm not identical to my ego. Maybe there's another place to stand and take in reality. And that was this expanded sense of this very calm, disinterested, unburdened consciousness that just was. And I felt like I was taking part in it. It wasn't just mine. It wasn't egotistical consciousness. It was something else. And it turned out to be a really important experience that I brought into normal life when my ego came back on patrol and doing its usual thing. I had a little more distance on it. I could see when it was up to its old tricks, when it was getting defensive or not letting me think about hard things like death or whatever egos do. Now, egos are wonderful. The ego got the book written. I don't mean to impugn the ego entirely, but egos also can be punishing. And they trap us in stories about ourselves, and they limit the potential for change, I think. So, I could have gotten that in 10 years of psychoanalysis, perhaps, some perspective on my ego, but I got it in an afternoon, and that was pretty remarkable.
And do you think you got it in an afternoon because you were open to it and you went through all the procedures with your guide?
I got it in an afternoon partly because I had a good guide, somebody I trusted enough that I could absolutely let my ego go. I could absolutely surrender and give up my defenses. And that's not something I don't think would have ever happened on my own. It also happened because it was a fairly high dose of psilocybin. It was comparable to the dose being used in the above ground trials. But it's not like I was eager for this experience. The night before, I was really very worried about it. And every time I did one of these trips, my ego tried to talk me out of it. And it would say, you're going to this place you don't know with this stranger. You could have a heart attack. Is this person going to call 911 because it's going to get them arrested? Maybe they won't. I had all these arguments that, all of which said, you're crazy to do this. You could die up there. And I realized, though, that was my ego trying to protect itself from what was from the assault I was mounting on it. Mm-hmm. But every time when I ingested the substance, I was able to let it go and I was able to surrender. And I'm surprised because I'm kind of a control freak.
What about dampening the SS serotonin receptors? That's always a fear with things like Prozac.
Yeah.
Is that also a fear with psychedelics?
No. They're not toxic to the brain. They're not toxic to the body. It's remarkable how non-toxic. There's no lethal dose. MDMA, which is also sometimes called a psychedelic, does temporarily deplete serotonin levels, it appears, and people who use it too often, it loses its effect. And so that has kind of a more persisting effect on the brain. Although the way it's being used in therapy is you don't have that many experiences, so it's not a serious concern. But there's no lethal dose for psychedelics. And there is, for Tylenol and Advil and all those drugs.
Yeah.
And they're non-addictive. So non-addictive and non-toxic. But, it does carry psychological risks. And there are people who definitely shouldn't take them. And people also, because their judgment is impaired, do foolish things on psychedelics. They walk into traffic. I'm sure people have fallen out of buildings or jumped out of buildings. So, that's why the guide is so important. The guide can take care of your body so you don't do anything really stupid.
Are you worried at all that you are at risk talking about this? You're doing illegal drugs. You're talking about illegal activities.
Yeah, well, I'm no longer doing illegal drugs. It's important for any authorities listening to know. And that when I did them is very unclear from the book. How many years ago was it? And where I did it. So, I'm very careful about how I describe it. And so I'm hoping I haven't constructed a usable confession. And I probably haven't. You need more than someone saying they had an experience. They'd have to prove it and find the drugs and all that kind of stuff. So, I hope these drugs do become prescribable by therapists and that they are approved, because I would like to do it again.
But whether I'll go underground or not, I don't think so. I mean, now that I have some visibility out talking about this, I think that would be foolish.
Yeah. Well, do you think these drugs should be legalized entirely or just legalized
not entirely.
For therapeutic reasons?
It's a very complicated question. Prohibition is not always the best solution for drugs because you can't regulate drugs if they're simply illegal. Whereas, as we're seeing with marijuana, you can legalize them and then you have rules on who can have access to them and how they can be packaged and the warning labels and all this kind of stuff, which you definitely need. So I think there's some regulatory regime we need to design around psychedelics. Yes, I think if the research pans out and there's still phase three to be done, which is starting this year, doctors should be able to prescribe it. But I also think that there are many others of us who don't have pathologies, are not clinically depressed or anxious or facing their death imminently, that stand to gain from this. And so we have to figure out a way to make it available to other people. But I do feel it needs to be in this carefully controlled situation, that they are too powerful for many people to take on their own.
Well, Michael Pollan, thank you so much. This has been fascinating.
My pleasure, Madeline. Great talking to you.
You too. That's Michael Pollan. His latest book is called How to Change Your Mind, What the New Science of Psychedelics Teaches Us About Consciousness, Dying, Addiction, Depression, and Transcendence. All right, Christian Bordahl is here now with some listener feedback.
Hey there, Madeline.
Hi.
How was your long weekend? Are you back refreshed and...
Well, I took a bunch of acid. No, just kidding.
That's what I was going to say. Tell us all about it.
I'm still tripping.
I didn't take any, but
he does make it sound very
appealing.
I know.
I was reading...
It sounds more interesting than my weekend. I'll just put it that way.
Right. I was reading Andrew Sullivan wrote a response in New York Magazine.
Uh-huh.
He wrote, "The great mystery to me of psychedelic experiences is the centrality of love. I mean, why is it love exactly, overwhelming love that so many experience under the spell of these molecules? I have felt this every single time I have ingested a psychedelic."
Every single time.
Apparently. And Pollan says the same thing in his book. He says when he's tripping, he feels this great sense of love and compassion. And he says platitudes, like love, suddenly take on this sense of like a deeply revealed truth, which is kind of cool.
Yeah.
Holt Clark writes, "We've painted the majority of mind-altering substances with the same brush and forbid their use, which is absurd. We know caffeine and ethyl alcohol have entirely different effects. Humans use them accordingly. Psychedelics are no different. They can be tools." So I asked our listeners whether they thought...
I will say,
yes,
it's a little different drinking a cup of coffee and yes, taking a mushroom. I just,
You're just straightening that.
just
making
stating
that
the
clear.
Obvious.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks for clearing that up for us, Madeline
sure,
Brand.
The Department of the Obvious.
Uh-huh. Asked listeners whether they thought psychedelic drugs should be legalized. Clayton Carlisle says, yes, absolutely. All drugs should be legal, like alcohol and tobacco. Portugal did it. Mr. Smallins agrees. Aladdin Sane says, no, bad idea. Of course, I polled on this. Mac Daddy Jones says, this is very important. Vote wisely. So, here are the wise votes. 45% say, yes, legalize it. 22% say, yes, with a prescription. 20% say, no way. 13% not sure. 45% legalize it.
All of it?
Yeah, anything.
Right. Okay.
Go.
Why not? All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.